And welcome back into Morning Drive here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Robbie Stanley alongside Joe Rexrode from The Athletic taking you through this Monday morning here in Nashville, Tennessee. We're pleased to welcome Jeremy Fowler, ESPN senior NFL reporter, who does a great job on ESPN through our microphone. Jeremy, thanks for taking the time to come on with us. We appreciate it.
Hey, no problem, guys. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So what have you been up to lately with all the social distancing and everything happening right now in our country? What's a typical day look like for Jeremy Fowler right now?
Oh, you know, just helping out with a little homeschool for some third grade math mixed in with some free agency phone calls. And then we have a 2-year-old as well. So that's always interesting. So trying to, stay here at the house and stay safe and make the best of it, you know, as we all are.
Absolutely. Well, Jeremy, we've been talking a lot this morning on the show about Jadeveon Clowney and maybe the Titans' potential interest in him. And you hear some numbers being floated out there that maybe he's looking for around $20 million per year. When you evaluate Jadeveon Clowney, what do you think he is worth? And what do you think should be a number that teams in the NFL are willing to go to when it comes to signing him?
Well, it's been really difficult to pinpoint what he should be worth and what he'll actually get. I think he went into the process wanting 20. I don't think he's going to quite get there. But I know he's evaluating all options, including a shorter-term deal, maybe 1 or 2 years, at a high number close to that. Either teams have slow-played him or they simply don't think he's worth that because they're not in his ballpark right now, and that's why he continues to wait. Now, I have heard the Titans a little bit around the three or four teams you hear the most. I've heard the Browns are at least keeping tabs on this. And Seattle, of course, has made the biggest push to keep him, but they haven't gotten any closer on the money that he would like. And so he's willing to wait, and he's willing to do a shorter-term deal if he has to. So it's been tough to figure out the Titans' interest because they went and got Vic Beasley. He could always use more help. The problem is if Clowney's production with the sacks isn't there, so if you put him at the end of, the top 10 market of edge rushers, that pays about $17 million. I think a number of teams would pay him that, but they wouldn't go to 20.
So there's some talk, Jeremy, about Clowney taking this into camp. At that point, you've got teams who, of course, have then invested in draft picks, undrafted free agents, have tried to address other needs through this period. I mean, to me, doesn't that bring the price tag down too much for him to wait that long?
Well, possibly. It's a risk either way. But, it could work out if one of the teams that was talking with him or looking at him goes into the draft and doesn't get a pass rusher they want. The problem with the wide receivers in free agency is you knew that receiver class in the draft was loaded. Pass rusher, there are certainly good pass rushers, and Chase Young is at the top of that list. But, is the depth there where if you're, say, the Titans, can you get a really good guy in the first couple rounds? Or if you strike out there, do you circle back with Clowney? So it could go both ways for him. I don't see it getting to camp. I think, in the next couple weeks something will get done before the draft. But, you look at Frank Clark a year ago with the trade with the Chiefs. They gave up high draft capital, paid him over $20 million as a pass rusher. And, he had a little bit better numbers than Clowney as far as raw sacks, but that got done right before the draft. So I think maybe the draft will serve as an unofficial deadline for some of these teams.
Jeremy Fowler from ESPN on the line with us. And, Jeremy, as you might imagine, Derrick Henry is a very popular topic of conversation here locally among Titans fans. The Titans have placed the franchise tag on him. As you evaluate the running back position and how general managers are approaching paying those guys in today's NFL, how do you kind of strike the balance of evaluating each guy on a case-by-case basis versus evaluating the position as a whole and its current importance in the NFL?
Yeah, well, the Titans have to do both, and they absolutely have to do the latter because it's brutal out there for running backs right now where I almost feel for Derrick Henry a little bit because if you're a guy who carries your team at times, based on your production and your position, you should be killing it right now at a huge number, and it's just not going to happen. I've heard of prominent agents that don't recruit running backs anymore, just because they know the payout's not going to be there. You look like a guy like Melvin Gordon, that's largely considered a top 10 running back in his prime. Now he came off a bad year because he held out, but he leaves with $8 million on a 2-year deal with the Broncos. It's just, the deals with Todd Gurley and Le'Veon Bell and David Johnson not working out for those teams when that was at the height of the money and that was already considered a stretch, it hurts everybody else. And so, but, you know, that said, Henry is unique to the Titans and what they do. He's obviously such a huge percentage of what they do on offense, you know, just by himself. And so that deserves a payout, and they really value him. And so I think, you know, there's probably a sweet spot you can find where you're not going to the Todd Gurley money, but you're not insulting him either.
Yeah, it's amazing. I kind of forgot this, but looking back for something I wrote about this, Jeremy, I mean, you know, Chris Johnson nearly a decade ago got, you know, 13 plus a year. And that's that just kind of tells you how the running back market has stalled or even gone the other way. Do you think that there's a talent drain coming then? I know there's been some really good running backs who have said, I think I'll play linebacker instead. I mean, do you think, you know, a few years down the road, we're going to see that manifest itself in the talent available at the position?
I do. I could see it. Maybe not yet, but because, you know, so many good players play running back at an early age, and then they carry it into high school and college. But, you know, the more this game gets specialized, you know, a guy's going to say, look, man, I got good feet. I'm fast. I'm going to go play cornerback. You know, I think that's probably the way that it's going, you know, because you look at the teams that have won big and won Super Bowls, and the Patriots obviously are one of them, where they don't have to rely on that kind of running back. Get a guy like James White, who's a really talented pass catcher, good all-around running back, but he's not going to get you 1,500 rushing yards, but you can certainly win with him, and you can pay him six. You know, I think that's just where the game is going.
Jeremy, when you look at Cam Newton, 30 years old, you would think there's a lot of good football left in him, but certainly injuries have been the main concern as of late. How do you evaluate Cam Newton right now? What do you think he has left in the tank in his NFL career?
Well, it's not that he doesn't have anything left, but, you know, some people, some execs are in the league do look at him as sort of damaged goods at this point, you know. With all the injuries that have mounted, you know, his play was not very good in recent years. And, you know, but that's the problem is that he's clearly a winner too. And he's clearly a starting caliber NFL player who's won an MVP. So it's like, I think the issue here is you almost have to be all in on Cam or all out. And, you know, teams that even are in transition a little bit, like say the Chargers, you know, if you want to get a draft pick at six overall or get Tua, you know, you already have Tyrod Taylor, who's a steady veteran. That might be a safer formula than, like, say, he'll get Cam where, you know, I don't know if many teams want Cam as their backup right now. You know, he might have to end up doing that, but, right, you know, he still looks at himself as a starter, and he absolutely should. So I just, you know, teams are deciding right now, at least, to be all out. Now, that could change. And we mentioned, you know, the draft with Clowney, it could be a similar case with Cam, or maybe he waits, and then a team that needs a quarterback strikes out, and then they say, well, look, we can win with Cam. We can certainly win games with him. You know, part of his issue right now is you can't give him a physical, so they don't know the health of his foot and his shoulder. And those are two key issues that he's dealt with the last few years that they've got to get hashed out.
So, Jeremy, Bruce Arians has shot down this idea of Tom Brady linking up with Antonio Brown in Tampa Bay, and with some pretty strong words, actually, about why he's not going to fit there. Basically, you know, he wouldn't fit in the locker room. Where do you think things go from here for Antonio Brown?
Well, the problem is he needs to get suspended first, right?
Yeah.
So he can get that on the books and serve the games. But, you know, it's my understanding, at least, that he hasn't even been at the point where he can be suspended, because you have to do things on a checklist to get to that point. You know, like you got to go through your counseling and all that, you know, take your steps behind the scenes at the NFL. I don't know how far he is on that. Last I checked, he wasn't very far. And so, you know, he's two or three steps away in that regard. And, you know, he wants to play. We all know he can help teams, but do they want him in their locker room? I don't know that a lot of teams do right now. It would have to take the perfect, you know, strong head coach quarterback scenario. That's why New Orleans maybe came to mind at one point. But, you know, they signed Emmanuel Sanders, and Emmanuel Sanders and Antonio Brown are clearly not friends after some of their Twitter beef. So it's complicated to have to take the right team. And, you know, I could see it happening if he could just get to the point where, I'm suspended six games and I'm serving my games, and coming out of that, I can help a team in the playoff run. I think that's how it would have to go.
Jeremy, last thing for you here. When you look around the league and some of the moves that have been made so far, what are some teams that you really like what they've done so far in the offseason and free agency?
Ooh, let's see. So I like what the Eagles did, you know, because they waited a year on Darius Slay, so they got a really good cornerback for just a third and fifth round pick, where a year ago they would have had to have given up more for him. This is a team that just really needed cornerback help, and it got it. And then they got Javon Hargrave, a good interior pass rusher at a decent price. So, you know, I like what they did. Obviously, Tampa, it's hard to not like what they did, not only for Tom Brady, but, just, you know, they kept a lot of their defensive pieces together with the Dominican Sue, Jason Pierre-Paul, Shaq Barrett. That defense is going to be pretty solid. You know, so those are two to come to mind. But, you know, the Bengals are funny because they spent a ton, and it's I don't know if it's all the right spending, but I kind of like the aggressiveness for a team that's never really been aggressive in free agency. You know, trying to make a statement that they have the number one overall pick, and it's going to be probably Joe Burrow, and so they're all in on that. And I like that mentality.
Jeremy Fowler from ESPN has been our guest here on Morning Drive. Jeremy, thanks so much for joining us, and hope you and your family continue to stay safe through the craziness going on right now in our country.
Okay, sounds great, guys. You too. Stay safe, and we'll talk to you soon.
Absolutely. Sounds good. When we come back, we'll continue the NFL discussion, also react a little bit to what Jeremy had to say there about Derrick Henry as well. That's coming up next. This is Morning Drive with Robbie Stanley and Joe Rexrode here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. That was Jeremy Fowler from ESPN joining us in the last segment, talking about Titans running back Derrick Henry and just kind of the uncertainty they have going forward with him. Welcome back into Morning Drive. Robbie Stanley alongside Joe Rexrode from The Athletic. And Joe, one of the interesting things we talked about there and that you heard Jeremy bring up, agents, some prominent agents around the league not really recruiting running backs as clients anymore just because they know the payout's not going to be there. That was a really fascinating part of that discussion that, quite honestly, I hadn't even thought about yet.
Yeah. I mean, again, it's a dirty word. The running back is a you do not want that applied to you. You know, it's just like if you are a running back, then you, like, there's a problem with you. You know, I talked to Joel Corey for this column today on Derrick Henry, and some stuff, it made me think of some stuff he was talking about that didn't make the column, but like Shaq Thompson was a great running back, you know, and apparently Washington, he was like, yeah, I'll go ahead and be a linebacker. And he's not a great linebacker, but $13 million a year, that's better than, you know, the very, very best running backs, yeah, you know, make. Miles Jack's another guy, you know, 14-plus as a linebacker, could have been apparently a great running back, you know, went the linebacker route. I mean, that's the thing, you know, Nick Saban has talked a little bit about Derrick Henry. And I think Nick Saban was more open to Derrick Henry being a running back in college. And a lot of other coaches out there were like, this is a great linebacker. And obviously Derrick Henry, you know, just unbelievable runner in high school, as you can imagine. But still, a lot of coaches looked at him like, imagine him as a linebacker. And I can imagine that. I mean, think about Derrick Henry as a linebacker. I think he'd probably be all right. He'd probably be in the NFL. You know, and the sad thing is he'd be making more money, you know? It's just – so that's interesting. And I think the talent drain part of it is interesting too. I mean, how many kids are going to try to do something else? Receiver, you know, obviously, you know, there's a lot of players in high school who can play quarterback or running back and maybe kind of do both. But playing defense instead of playing running back, I think the talent at the position. I mean, look, you're always going to find people who love to carry the ball, but you're probably going to see a lot of people who could have been special running backs who were playing something else.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point. And, you know, we talked about that a couple weeks ago on the show in terms of, like, if I'm a high school recruit right now and I'm a really good running back at the high school level, but I'm looking ahead towards, like, my long-term, you know, prospects of playing football, wouldn't, like, moving to receiver or maybe to cornerback on the other side of the ball, like, you know, a lot of times you're 16, 17, 18 years old when you're making these decisions and you just feel like you'll be different and maybe you don't look ahead that far. But I feel like the more and more this happens and the more and more that these high school recruits have people around them, feeding them advice, coaches feeding them advice, I think the more we're going to see some of these really talented running backs in high school start to shift positions, maybe not immediately, maybe they do get into college football and they're still playing the running back position. But as they transition and start to look ahead for their NFL careers and their futures, I wouldn't be surprised at all to see some of these guys move from, you know, running back to receiver or running back to cornerback, whatever the case may be.
Yeah, and football wouldn't be as good right now at this moment if Derrick Henry was not a running back.
Absolutely.
You know, Derrick Henry has brought a lot of joy to people being a running back. So I'm glad he's a running back, and this is part of why he needs to be paid as a running back. You know, Jeremy was talking about the Patriots. They're a great example of a franchise that has rarely, you know, Corey Dillon, but really has just sort of changed out running backs like light bulbs and been just fine with that. And definitely utilizing the running back as the pass receiver out of the backfield. But, you know, think about that Super Bowl a couple years ago. I wonder if the perception would be helped at all. It, you know, if Todd Gurley would not have gotten hurt as he obviously did late in that season. I mean, that team offensively was dreadful in the Super Bowl. You know, they were relying on Jared Goff, and the Patriots very good on defense. And, you know, I know that, you know, Sean McVay later said he outthought himself in game prep or whatever. But the bottom line is they were there because Todd Gurley was one of the top handful of weapons in the NFL, and then he wasn't. And so what if Gurley didn't get hurt and dominated the Super Bowl and they won it? Then you could at least put to rest the idea of, well, the great running back never leads to anything right now in the NFL. It very nearly did. And, again, you can contrast the Rams with great Gurley and the Rams with not good Gurley and how different the Rams are either way. But that's one of those things people forget about when they talk about, you know, running backs not mattering. I mean, Marshawn Lynch, when the Seahawks were in Super Bowls, why were they in Super Bowls? Russell Wilson, yes. Great defense. You know, Legion of Boom, yes. Marshawn Lynch, yeah. And they haven't been back since.
Yeah, that's a great point. We got a text in on the text line regarding, you know, the conversation we were having earlier about high school running backs. A text says, the high school coach in my town makes the running back skip every other game and play a different position half the time because he thinks the position is dying. I mean, that you're talking about a high school coach with that thought, where running the ball is probably more prevalent than any other part of the sport. So if that's the case with a high school coach, just imagine – you know, what college coaches and NFL coaches are thinking about right now.
Yeah. And again, I just see, you look around. We're just talking about the Rams, Sean McVay. You know, everyone's gaga about Sean McVay and that coaching tree. He was heavily reliant on a great running back, and they paid him. And like, I trust, you know, like Bill Plaschke, LA Times, you know, great writer, been a columnist there a long time. You know, when they cut Todd Gurley, he wrote the column, and I agree with him. Like, you had to do this. This is the right move. Also, when you paid him, you had to pay him too. Like, it doesn't make that move a bad move. It's just that, look, he got hurt, you gambled, and you lost. But paying him at that point made sense too, because, again, you were a Super Bowl caliber team largely because you relied on that guy, and that guy was one of the best football players in the world when he was healthy, when he, you know, when he had that stretch of time. The knee was not a factor for him, and then it came back. I mean, so it's just – I mean, look at Shanahan, and I know Raheem Mostert's an example of a guy not getting paid, but how important was he to their success this year? Hugely important. Yeah. When Kyle Shanahan was the OC in Atlanta, Devontae Freeman and Tevin Coleman as a tandem, but especially Devontae Freeman, he got paid because of 2016, the year he had. He was a great player. Oh, by the way, that's the year they got to the Super Bowl. So I think the position is, it's going to be hard, obviously, to get paid and make what most other positions are making. There's inflation around the NFL everywhere else but running back. And so I understand, like, why you would want to play somewhere else. But there's the idea that you don't need a running game now, even for these teams that are perceived as passing teams. I think that's bunk. And balance in football has always worked, and balance in football is going to continue to work.
I agree, and I keep going back to the point you bring up, Joe, of durability. I mean, I think when you look at Derrick Henry, that's got to be, you know, one of the biggest parts of his argument is, yeah, you look at Todd Gurley coming into the league, he had a major knee injury before he even set foot in the NFL. You go back through Derrick Henry's time at Alabama, his time with the Titans so far, he's had some bruises and some bumps and a hamstring injury every now and then, but there's no like major injury to point to where you're just like, ah, I don't know about this guy moving forward. And part of that, quite frankly, is just the science behind it of he is gigantic. He is a gigantic human being running the football, and it's really, really hard to tackle him, number one. But number two, it's even harder to deliver a big-time shot on a guy like that because most of the time, Derrick Henry is the one doing the hitting, not receiving the hitting. And certainly, look, you can get hurt at any point playing football. I get it. Even if you're a guy that's as big as Derrick Henry is, he's not immune to getting hurt, and I understand that. I do think for a guy that size with as much speed as he has and just the power he runs with, I do think it's less likely that a guy like him gets hurt rather than some of these shiftier backs that come out of the backfield.
Yeah, and there's some of these injuries over time, you know, they're hard to shake. Like David Johnson had a back thing. You know, back stuff is just – that is really hard to get over. And, of course, he dislocated a wrist too. I mean, right. And he had a knee. You know, some of these guys, they have these nagging things, like you mentioned, Gurley with the knee. That was a wrist coming in for a short period of time. He got over it, and he was great. You know, because everyone knew that he was, you know, a special talent, but that was a risk. The thing with Derrick Henry is, of course, you can always have – the one moment where a helmet gets a knee and it plants in the ground and, you know, or whatever it is. You can have a terrible injury in the NFL. Anyone can. But there's no accumulation that we know of right now with Derrick Henry that suggests that he's going to start falling apart here. Players do at some point, and it happens. But he's 26 right now. He's in about as good a shape as you can be in, and I would bet right now that he's figuring out a way to stay in shape. So, again, I think the risk there is lower than with a lot of guys.
I think so, too, and going to be interesting to monitor how the Titans handle that moving forward. When we come back, Seth Greenberg from ESPN will join us, the great college basketball analyst, and we'll get into what are some of the best NCAA performances that we've seen by a player. That'll be next. This is Morning Drive with Robbie Stanley and Joe Rexroad here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Welcome back into Morning Drive here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Robbie Stanley alongside Joe Rexroad from The Athletic, and very pleased to bring our next guest on the show. Seth Greenberg does a great job for ESPN as a college basketball analyst. Seth, what's going on, my man? How are you?
Hanging in there. How you guys doing? You guys staying safe, making good decisions, staying at home, and just making good choices or what?
Yeah, so far so good. I think my wife's growing tired of me staying at home right now. But what have you been up to for the past few weeks? While normally right now we'd be breaking down the NCAA tournament, and we've just kind of been forced to live a different reality lately.
Yeah, you know, the NCAA tournament's probably least of society's problems, although it's a great distraction. You know, we've had this 64 greatest players in the history of college basketball, and I've been doing this from my office studio. So I've had some fun with that. And, you know, quite honestly, spending time with family and just making sure everyone is safe. I mean, it's great that CBS is putting these games on. It's great catching up to all the old 30 for 30s, watched the Celtics and the Lakers the other day, cleaning out off my office, cleaning out closets, all the kind of fun things that I've put off for years and years and years. But surely we miss it. I feel for those kids. I feel for the seniors. I feel for the teams that, like the Hofstras and the Rutgers and the teams that, you know, are going for the first time in a long time. I mean, it's, you know, you just feel for those kids, but hopefully we'll get through this. We'll get through it together. Hopefully eventually we'll stop being political across the country and just say, we're going to be one team and one America and not have to win a debate, but just say that, you know what, we're all in this thing together. We all need to pull in the same direction. We all need to have the same understanding and the same commitment to each other that the medical people are putting together. Because when you look at the doctors and you look at the nurses, they are without a doubt one team. The rest of our country needs to be one team as well.
Amen.
Yeah, really well said. So Seth, when you look back at some of the things going on right now, and one of the conversations that's come up is the best NCAA tournament performance that you've seen by a player. And look, there are a lot of options you can go through. I mean,
wow.
Carmelo Anthony comes to mind to me, Kemba Walker as well. Like, there are a ton of different options. If I were to ask you what's, like, the best run you've seen a player put together in the NCAA tournament, what would your answer be?
That one's easy. Bill Walton, 21-22 in the national championship game.
Against Memphis, right? Or Memphis State.
Come on, 21-22. I mean, come on now. Kemba had a great run. There's no doubt about it. Probably only the one close to that would be Kareem. Three national championships, three most outstanding players. Obviously, they had great players on that team. But, I mean, look, you know, they changed the rules for Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Now, think about that.
Yeah.
Like, they could not guard him. That's how he developed, started off as a sweeping hook, then it ended up the sky hook. If you took away his left shoulder, he spun back the other way and laid it in with his left hand. He was pretty amazing. But, I mean, Bird, 21-22, Kemba had an incredible run. I mean, it's hard to ignore what Kemba did. There's no doubt about it. And, we've been doing this greatest 64 players, and, like, you know, I'm getting a lot of grief because I picked Magic over Michael Jordan yesterday, and Michael Jordan was phenomenal. Michael Jordan had that moment, that shot. But when you look at the players that Michael Jordan played with, look at the players he played with. All right, Worthy, Brad Daugherty, Sam Perkins, Kenny Smith, Jimmy Black. I mean, like, he played with four NBA All-Stars. Magic played with Greg Kelser and won a national championship. I understand how great Michael Jordan was, but he was, quite honestly, he was Michael Jordan then. He wasn't MJ. He was player of the year, but he didn't. The hardest, I coached in the ACC during that time. The toughest game preparation in that league at that moment in time was not Michael Jordan. It was Len Bias.
Yeah, it's amazing, Seth, you know, going through this list. You mentioned Magic, and for people who don't remember, Greg Kelser was like top, you know, draft pick guy who hurt his knee and didn't have the NBA career. He was a great college player, but to your point, it's not Perkins, Worthy, and all those guys. But I'm looking at, like, you know, starting out, Magic Johnson. I mean, Glenn Rice is a 14 seed, you know, in this bracket, a guy who averaged 31 points in a run all the way to the championship. I mean, the depth, obviously, of talent and achievement on this list is pretty amazing. Anyone on this list that when you first saw the bracket, you were like, whoa, really?
Yeah, Trey Jones. Trey Young shouldn't have been on this list. I mean, that was ridiculous. Look, he was a nice player in college. I mean, he played 1 year. They shouldn't have made the NCAA tournament. The logo range thing was, you know, out of control. But, I mean, those guys lost like 8 of their last 9 games. You know, come on now. I mean, Isaiah Thomas wasn't on the list.
Yeah.
Walt Hazard, Gail Goodrich, Elgin Baylor. I mean, come on. I mean, like, those guys, you know, were ridiculous. I also thought that I wish we didn't put the women in it because I think the women deserve their own bracket because Cheryl Miller changed the women's game. She was the first woman player that had that pizzazz, that style, that grace, that flair. And then, like, Shamika Hoskuo, she didn't get past Trae Young. She didn't get past Trae Young. I mean, she was consecutive national champion. And she was two-time player of the year, the all-time leading scorer in the history of the SEC for women's basketball. Come on now. That doesn't make any sense. So, but it, you know, I'll tell you what it was. It was a great fun exercise. Pistol Pete. I mean, he got no respect. I mean, Pistol Pete, the dude averaged 44 points a game without the 3-point shot. He changed basketball in the SEC. All right, he was appointment. Every time he went and played a game, it was an event. I know he didn't make the NCAA tournament, but come on, 44 points a game. Imagine how many points a game he would score with the three. And if you take the points and assists, like, he had a hand in like 60 points a game. Like, the big O, not you know, like I looked at this thing, like, they had Shaq beating Lew Alcindor or Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. They had the big O losing to Kemba Walker. Come on, America. I mean, the big O. We're talking the big O. Give you, I mean, like, the big O, 33 points a game, got the ball anywhere he wanted, anytime he wanted. All right, 15 rebounds a game, two Final Fours. I mean, the Big O. People forget how good. So context is so important. Look, Big O doesn't have a Twitter handle. Big O doesn't have Instagram. You know, we basically, you know, got lost in the moment. And the people that are voting on this are the millennials and the Generation Y or X, whatever they're calling them. And that's great. And that's great. It's great. And look, I think it's great that it gets people thinking about it. Like I said, the thing that I feel worst about is and I think the NCAA did the right thing by not announcing the field, because you had 20 more automatic bids that were out there. That wouldn't have been fair to those 20 leagues that had teams that had an opportunity to advance. You know, I feel bad for the kids, said Hofstra. I feel bad for the kids at Rutgers. I feel bad for the Kansas kids who might have made a run and won a national championship. But when you put it in perspective, I say Rudy Gobert, as ignorant and as selfish and as immature as what he did, when he tested positive, it changed the way the sports world looked at the coronavirus. And in a lot of ways, he probably saved lives.
Yeah, no question about it. I think that's a great point you bring up there. Seth, I want to ask you a tough one here. There's a lot to choose from, but what's when you look back at either your career or games that you've watched over the years, what's the most memorable college basketball game that you can remember seeing or being a part of?
Well, being a part of, I was really fortunate. I had some really good players in some different places. I mean, when we went to Kansas after losing by 400 points at BCU, and then we flew to Kansas and played Kansas at Kansas when they were number one, and we were fortunate to win by about 16. That was a pretty cool moment for those kids. My senior group at Virginia Tech that went through so much tragedy. We lost on that half-court shot to Duke the year before, and then we had two or three parents pass away from cancer during the middle of the season. It was absolutely brutal. For that group to stay together, win at Duke and win at Carolina within 5 days or 6 days of each other, whatever it was pretty amazing. You know, I was fortunate to have really good players and really good kids that – it's interesting. This is something other people should do. like I've taken those three teams, and I've got group texts with those three teams individually to make sure that they're all checking on each other. We've got 30 and 40 guys in a text of the three teams, schools I was a head coach at. And it's kind of a great exercise of bringing people together and sharing those moments. So I could, you know, to the people listening out there, if you have a group of people that you had an incredible shared experience with, or whether it's a team or a place you worked or a group of friends, I really urge you to try to put a text chain together and stay in touch and catch up and share memories. And, you know, because in times like this, you know, everyone needs a support system. Times like this, you know, we miss certain things, but it's also a challenge in terms of your mental health. And to have support systems out there that can be behind you and with you and bring back memories that can put a smile on your face, who knows what, you know, whose life you can impact in some way. So, you know, I was fortunate. I had some incredible, incredible memories. But one that I didn't participate in, though, as a coach, I was at the game that Willis Reed came out of that tunnel.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow.
I was in the last row of Madison Square Garden. That seat does not exist anymore because it's a box now. But I was there. And every time I ever coached in Madison Square Garden, when they had that tunnel still available, it surely flashed me back to 13 years old, Willis coming out of that tunnel. Then they reconfigured the garden. They closed up that area because they made them seats because they were – obviously very good seats. And every time I've been to the garden since they did, you know, I would literally walk to center court and stop and kind of close my eyes and flash back to that moment with my dad at the garden at that game.
Seth Greenberg from ESPN has been our guest here on Morning Drive. Seth, thanks so much for taking the time to come on with us, and continued safety to you and your family as we go through this time.
Same to you guys. Be safe.
Hey, thanks, Seth. Oh, when we come back, I want to get into a little bit more of what we talked about with Seth there. What's the best NCAA tournament performance you've seen by a player? We'll get into that next. This is Morning Drive with Robbie Stanley and Joe Rexroad here on ESPN 102.5. Welcome back into Morning Drive here on ESPN 102.5. The Game, Robbie Stanley alongside Joe Rexroad from The Athletic. And Joe, we've tossed an interesting question out there. The best NCAA tournament performance we've seen out of a player, and kind of the way that I'm approaching this, at least from my point of view in this conversation, is just a single run in the NCAA tournament. So, you know, you can talk about guys that played in the tournament, you know, 3 or 4 years in a row, or, you know, maybe won multiple national championships. I'm approaching this as like through one tournament, the best runs that we've seen. And Joe, I think there are a lot of options out there. We got a text in on the text line that talks about Christian Laettner and the shot that he had from Rob. A text that we got there. There's Bill Walton that Seth Greenberg mentioned in the last segment, who averaged, I think, 23.8 points per game during that run and had 44 points in the title game against Memphis. I keep coming back to Kemba Walker because I look at what he did. I think UConn was a 9 seed in the Big East tournament. They find a way to win that tournament. They won 5 games in 5 days. I think Kemba averaged like 27 points a game or something like that. I mean, he was just unconscious. He was unbelievably good. And they find their way to win a national championship with Kemba Walker averaging 23.5 points. And maybe the biggest thing that stood out to me, Kemba Walker played every single minute but 9 minutes throughout the entire NCAA tournament. Only 9 minutes was he not on the floor in the NCAA tournament. And Kemba Walker, that run he put together in 2011 was unbelievable.
No doubt. I think that has to be, in terms of individual greatness on a run, and especially if you do consider the Big East tournament. That was the famous, I believe that was, yes, that was the Big East tournament where, you know, he had the step back, crossover step back against Pittsburgh. It looked like he shot the guy and, you know, hit that shot, and they just kept winning. That was unbelievable. See, I was thinking in this question in terms of stuff I've seen in person, and actually it brings me to another UConn guy, because Shabazz Napier was, you know, as surprising as that UConn run was to the title in 11, which, by the way, finished with probably the worst title game I've ever seen. UConn-Butler, 53-41, just an unwatchable, awful game. And Butler's second straight trip to the title and title game loss. But Shabazz Napier in 2014, you know, that guy was incredible. And I got to see it up close, because in the Elite Eight, that Michigan State, the team I covered, was supposed to take care of them at the Garden, Madison Square Garden, that, you know, Seth Greenberg was just talking about. And they were, I think Michigan State was up 9 in the second half. He turned it on, dominated from there, and they won. And he, you know, took it all the way. I mean, they beat Florida. They beat Kentucky. I remember, I think LeBron James tweeted like something like, you know, we need to get him on my team right now, Shabazz Napier. I mean, that's another one. And it's another one. It's one of those names that, you know.
Yes, trust me. As a fan of the Miami Heat, I saw that tweet, and we did end up drafting Shabazz Napier, and that was a total disaster, but I digress.
Well, right, so that's the thing. So because his NBA career was not at all what it was supposed to be, and sometimes NCAA tournament runs can you know, inflate a guy's value, even in the eyes of scouts and GMs. So, but because his NBA career wasn't, you know, what it was hoped to be, people forget about that, but that was unbelievable as a run, what he did. So the fact that UConn had two guys like that in the span of 4 years, two teams that really weren't built on paper to win at all, but they did with two guards doing what they did. I mean, those are, I think both of those stand out to me.
I want to toss one at you, Joe, that maybe a lot of people wouldn't think about, because you look at the stats and they don't blow you away. I mean, over 19 points a game, 9 rebounds a game. But a guy who I thought was essential in his team winning the tournament for UCLA, and that's Ed O'Bannon. I mean, he came in there in 1995 and just put together a great run. And that's the last time that UCLA, when you think about the storied program that they have with the Bruins there in UCLA, that's the last time they won a national championship with Ed O'Bannon.
Yeah, no doubt. And, of course, people know Ed O'Bannon better now for name, image, likeness. I mean, his name you know, has a different meaning now, but he was absolutely great. I mean, usually in these runs, you know, you have obviously the Leitner angle there. I mean, Leitner was unbelievable in those championship runs in 91 and 92. I'm sure a lot of people have caught up on the, you know, the win over Kentucky in 92. I mean, you know, they probably shouldn't have been in the Final Four, but he hits that shot. You've got, you know, O'Bannon's a good one for sure. You know, you talk about Boeheim, Syracuse, his only national title. Carmelo Anthony as a freshman. I mean, Carmelo was unbelievable. Obviously, you think Florida was very well constructed, but I still think of, you know, Al Horford and Joakim Noah as they were the driving forces. And those teams, dominant teams, 2006, 2007, but, you know, going into that 05, 06 year, no one had any idea Florida was even going to be that good. But those two guys is big. Another one, I'll go from personal experience, Robbie. One of the and I covered this game in Houston in 2008, and I was like, that's going to be one of the greatest players ever. He had 27 and 5 in 26 minutes of action. His team was up 50 to 20 at the half. That's Derrick Rose of Memphis.
Oh, yeah.
And had they not totally blown that game, I think now, of course, then you also have things being vacated, so you have to keep that in mind too. But just as a player, in that 1 year of college basketball he played, I remember saying, like, after that game, like, that's going to be one of the greatest guards ever. And, you know, if not for injuries, I think I would have been right.
Yeah, I mean, injuries totally derailed him. I remember there was a game that took place, I think in, like, February of 2008 or maybe early January. I can't remember which one it was, between Tennessee and Memphis. And I think Tennessee was ranked number one in the nation.
Oh, yeah. Everybody remembers that game.
That was an incredible game. That was one of the best college basketball games that I've ever watched, between Derrick Rose and Memphis and Tennessee that year. It was unbelievable.
Yeah, no, he was special. And so, you know, that's what you have a lot, is you have the guy forced to be in college for 1 year, but it turns into, you know, a memorable year. Anthony Davis, I mean, that's the one title that John Calipari has won with Kentucky, and it was the 1 year he had Anthony Davis. You know, no coincidence there. Of course, he probably should have won another one, but Wisconsin got him in 2015. Some of these are great teams. I mean, Juan Dixon from Maryland in 2002. You know, a lot of guys who you know, and then they go high in the draft and they're not what they're supposed to be. I covered Michigan State in 2000, Mateen Cleaves and Morris Peterson, both first-round picks, and both were, you know, had okay pro careers. But, you know, you think of players differently based on their pro careers. You just do. Like Anthony Davis, he has been what he's supposed to be in the NBA. So you think, I think you think of guys' college careers differently too, based on what they do in the pros. You look at last year's champ, Virginia. I don't think anybody on that team is going to have a prominent NBA career. That was a great example of, you know, a great all-around team without one superstar player.
Yeah, and when we go through this discussion, like, we see Carmelo on the list, Anthony Davis as well, we've talked about. I just always go back to, I would have loved to have seen LeBron play college basketball for 1 year. Obviously, he made the right decision by coming out of high school. He was a freak athlete. He was a phenom. But just being able to watch LeBron play college basketball for 1 year, it would have been really interesting to see what he would have been able to do, because I think it's no stretch to say it would have been amazing, would have been memorable to say. I mean, we thought we had a lot of fun with Zion Williamson. I can't imagine the fun we would have had watching LeBron play college basketball.
Yeah, it would have been fun. You know, the thing about, like, Carmelo, people think about that, like, oh, yeah, one and done. Well, Carmelo could have gone right to the NBA. You know, Carmelo, sometimes guys go in and it's like, okay, yeah, you actually are ready to go play in the NBA. Go be a, and he was, and obviously we saw the career he's had. LeBron was at that era, you know, Kobe Bryant was going to go play at Duke. Imagine Kobe Bryant and Cameron for a year. You know, some of these guys during that time, when it was, you had the period of time where guys used to stay at least a couple years, if not 3 years. And then it became, you know, Kevin Garnett kind of really started that trend of a lot more guys going right to the NBA. So you had, I think Garnett was going to go to Michigan. You know, you had a lot of college careers or short college careers, at least, that you could think about. I mean, the one and done, there's a lot of problems with that rule, and I think it's right for the NBA to remove that rule and allow guys to come in, but it's been helpful for the NBA to be able to scout them for a year. And really, to me, it's not like cheating didn't exist in college basketball before. I mean, we've been able to see some incredible players in college basketball. Like you said, Zion's the latest example of a guy who, I mean, I wasn't turning – I was flipping to a Duke game last year way more just to watch him play.
Oh, yeah, I was too. No question about it. When we come back, Darren McFarland from Darren, Donick, and Chase will join us. We'll get into a bunch of this conversation with him next. But first, are you working from home during the COVID-19 pandemic? Stream us from anywhere. Download the Game Nashville app. Enable our Alexa or Google Home and ask to play 102.5 The Game or live stream from our website, thegamenashville.com. We'll be right back with Darren McFarland. That's next. This is Morning Drive with Robbie Stanley and Joe Rexroad here on ESPN 102.5 The Game.